There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We are here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the things that people are already talking about? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. They certainly don't need another opinion piece, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So who's going to give that to them? Well, I think that's the role of every single Christian in the culture today. We are the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, and it's our role and responsibility to take God back into the conversation. So if you want some resources to help you do that, we'd invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. We've got a new resource posted for you there, 3 tough questions about showing Jesus' love to our gay friends. For example, what if you get invited to a gay wedding of some friends? How do you respond to that? A couple weeks ago, we had Adam Barr on the show to talk about how we love our gay friends without compromising the truth of the gospel. And following that conversation, Adam wrote up a guest blog for us. It is now posted on reconnectwithcarmen.com, and it's entitled Compassion Without Compromise. Please go and make use of that resource today. All right, let's jump into the headlines of the day. The ongoing story of Charlie Gard. This is the 10-month, now 11-month-old, young British child. His parents were back in court today in London to see if they might be able to bring their baby to the United States for an experimental treatment. And so let me make a few comments from the article that we have from The Guardian this morning, posted just a couple of hours earlier today. In an emotional high court hearing on Monday, punctuated by angry interventions by Charlie's parents, Mr. Justice Francis said he would be delighted to be able to change his mind from the decision made in April not to allow the baby to be flown to the U.S., but it would take drastic new evidence for him to do so. So what kind of evidence is the court now looking for? Well, sitting in the high court were Charlie's parents, Connie Yates and Chris Gard, and the court has charged them to produce evidence by 2 p.m. Wednesday, evidence that they claim they have, including when that evidence was published and when it became available to them, and that there will be a hearing this coming Thursday in which the court will decide Charlie's fate. And what are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about a child who was born with a mitochondrial DNA defect, and it is degenerating his body. He has what doctors would describe as now irreversible brain damage. And so one of the things that Charlie Gard's parents must produce is that this treatment will not only be life-sustaining, but that the treatment has the possibility and potential of reversing the brain damage that the child has already experienced. So are they going to be able to do that? Grant Armstrong, speaking on behalf of Charlie's parents, told the court that a U.S. doctor had suggested to them that by a conservative estimate, the experimental treatment has a 10% chance of working for Charlie. Now, there's lots of words in there that you would want the definition of. What exactly does working for Charlie mean? A 10% chance of what precisely? And what does it mean for a U.S. doctor to suggest that there is a 10% chance that if the child receives this experimental treatment, that would, quote, work for him? What do all those words mean? And so that's what the judges are looking for. They're looking for actual documentation of this experimental treatment, what the hope of the experimental treatment is, what kind of percentage chance it gives to Charlie, and a chance of what. So one of Charlie's parents at that point loudly intervened. This is not so different for the way court works here in the United States. I mean, if the parents of the child were to scream out in the middle of a court hearing here in the United States, I feel confident the judge probably would not even respond to them. So it's interesting that there's this back and forth exchange then. Connie Yates, Charlie Gard's mother then intervene and addressed the judge directly, saying, 10%, you would do this if it were your son, wouldn't you? And in response, the judge said, if there is a 10% chance of recovery, including of brain damage, that would be significant, and that would be taken into account on Thursday's hearing. So I think that what the court is looking for in this case is actual evidence of what this experimental treatment is promising. And if it's actually promising a 10% chance of recovery, including recovery from what doctors in the UK regard as irreversible brain damage, then there's the possibility that the court would reverse itself and allow Charlie Gard's parents to bring him to the United States for this experimental treatment. Now, there are a number of other things going on here that I think we have to be responsible to take into account. We're two Republican members of Congress saying that they plan to introduce legislation that would grant lawful permanent resident status in the United States to this critically ill child, Charlie Gard, and his parents, allowing him to leave the UK and receive this experimental treatment here in the United States. Those two representatives are Brad Winstrup from Ohio and Trent Franks from Arizona. On behalf of the parents, they say, look, the parents have advocated for him fiercely. They have raised over £1 million to pay for their son to receive experimental treatment in the United States, and they have kept fighting for his life. Now, you guys know I'm pro-life. You know that I'm pro-life from conception to natural death. Conception to natural death has a limit on each end. On one end, the limit is conception. On the other end, it's natural death. And there's a conversation here that needs to be had about where we place our hope. All the king's horses and all the king's men could not undo what was already broken. And all of the hope that we might place, all of the hope that we might put in the powers and principalities and techniques and technologies of this world may not indeed be able to put back together what is already broken in this little baby. And we need to be praying for a miracle. There's no question about that. God could certainly still intervene in the life of this child. God could absolutely show his mercy to this child and to his parents and undo what sin has done in terms of the brokenness of this child's genetic code. At this point, short of a miracle, Charlie Gard is not going to recover his health. I'm not saying that his parents are not feeling the right things. I think that they are absolutely, they have the right desire to go to the ends of the earth to save their son. But the conversation about hope and the reality of where we place our hope is an important one to have. This world is not all that there is. And if your only hope is in the recovery of health in this life and the reversal of brain damage already experienced because of this mitochondrial DNA issue, your hope is in the wrong place. Your hope is misplaced. And your hope to be with your child again for all eternity needs to be put into the hands of the one who really does hold it all together, who puts you together at the cellular level and can redeem you even now. And his name is Jesus. And we have to be reminded also that we're having an ongoing conversation about whose baby is this. That conversation arose out of the decision of the court, contrary to the desire of the parents to remove Charlie from the hospital and let him die at home, and or what they still really are advocating for, which is that Charlie would be allowed to be flown here to the United States to receive an experimental treatment with the promise of reversing his mitochondrial DNA defect. But whose baby is this? No one is saying, hey, look, this child belongs to God. And we're going to talk about being pro-life from conception to natural death. At some point, natural death means we place ourselves back into the hands of God. Each one of us is going to die one day. It's going to happen. Whose child are you going to be then? Whose baby are you going to be then? It doesn't matter who you're born to in terms of flesh and blood. It doesn't matter what nationality you are. Ultimately, what matters in terms of whether or not you're a child of God is whether or not you've placed your life and all of the hope in it in the hands of Jesus. whether or not you are relying upon Jesus Christ for your salvation, that you might be adopted into God's family as one of his children. I would say that one of the issues here is the issue of money. And I think that we, as the people of the United States, absolutely need to consider whether or not, if we, the people of the United States, through an act of Congress, which two congressmen are proposing, the advocacy by our president, the significant investment of many pro-life and legal non-governmental organizations, I want you to consider all that is happening, everything that's been ginned up in relationship to this one British baby. And I want you to ask yourself, will we be found equally willing to do likewise for every other baby born in every other foreign country facing every other terminal threat that could be solved by bringing that child to America and granting their parents permanent resident status? And if you don't see the hypocrisy here related to the refugee crisis, then I need you to think about it for a minute longer. There is the offer here of medical care and medical treatment and bypassing every immigration and refugee control currently in place in order to do for this one child what we seem completely unwilling to do for children around the world who simply need clean water to drink or a mosquito net to keep them from getting malaria or very basic anti-diarrheal medication. I mean, the list here goes on and on and on and on. And if we are willing to set aside our concerns about the border and our concerns about healthcare expenses, and we're willing to set all of that aside and bring this one family to the United States, we are going to have to begin answering the question, why not for this one? And why not for this one? And why not for this one? And why not for this one? Because there may be a very limited number of Charlie Guards out there whose parents are frankly able to make their case on social media in such a compelling way and actually begin a global trend on behalf of this one child. But there literally is no limit to the number of Charlie Guards who are out there, who are babies in the world right now, little kids in the world right now, whose issues could absolutely, without question, be solved by bringing them to the United States. I mean, there's no question about it. Bring them here to the United States and just let them drink out of our water faucets and their lives, they will have healthy lives. Their health issues will be resolved. So I hope I don't sound merciless or heartless, because I certainly recognize that as parents, these parents are doing everything within their power to go to the very ends of the earth for their child. The question is, what will those of us who are at the ends of the earth in relationship to this do for every other child who finds themselves born into like circumstance? All right, shifting gears from the Charlie Guard case to a case here in the United States of a pastor and his family who are now living under constant harassment and physical threat and even vandalism of private property because he posted on a Facebook page the unwillingness of he and his Christian ministry to utilize or allow other people to utilize on their site an emoji from Facebook that highlights the gay pride flag. Yes, you have that correct. The unwillingness to allow the Facebook rainbow flag emoji on their particular has resulted in, I don't even know what to call this, an all-out effort on social media to terrorize this family. The kinds of things that are posted in LGBT advocacy sites about this individual, his ministry, and his family go something like this. Everyone, I have a task for you. Go and spam this homophobic hate page with softcore gay porn, softcore so we don't get banned. That's right. They are spamming this pastor, his family, and the ministry, not only Facebook page, but website, with, you got that, gay porn. They're also shipping feces to his home. So they have gone to the length of changing their address to that of the local police department. They have had their private physical property vandalized. And all of this is about an emoji, right? An emoji. An emoji on Facebook. Well, sometimes an emoji on Facebook is more than an emoji. And not anybody can just have any emoji they want on Facebook, by the way. In a counter effort a couple of weeks ago in relationship to this pride flag, gay pride flag emoji, some Christians wanted a different kind of emoji, sort of a pro-Christian emoji, and they started circulating ideas about that on June the 24th, apparently posting an image of a cross that they could use as a reaction to the rainbow emoji. Anyway, it's like an emoji fight out there, and it's a little bit crazy. Facebook has responded by saying to the Huffington Post, you can't actually use this Christian emoji. They didn't say Christian emoji. They're just referring specifically to this crucifix emoji with it has a cross in it. You can't actually choose this emoji. It's not available on Facebook, and it is not something we're even working on. So there is one kind of activist emoji available and not another kind of activist emoji. And you're saying to yourself, this seems like a utterly ridiculous conversation to be having. Is this really affecting anyone's life? This is probably just an isolated incident anyway, Carmen. I mean, one pastor, one group of people, you know, they're being affected. Bad things are happening. They're being targeted. They've had to change their address. They've had to change their phone number. But, you know, that's just one isolated incident. Well, it's not really an isolated incident. Rolling Stone has recently published a lengthy profile examining the contributions of Tim Gill. Tim Gill is a software entrepreneur who has quietly been at the forefront of the push for same-sex marriage and LGBTQ rights in the United States for several decades. He's actually pumped more than $422 million of his own money to advance LGBTQ causes. His goal was to not only change the definition of marriage in America, which clearly has been achieved, but now that same-sex marriage has been legalized nationally, Gill has continued to push forward in an effort to ensure the agenda that he desires, his preferred outcome in relationship to the everyone must bow down to us gay agenda. I don't have a nicer way to say it. That's the best way I have to say it. Here's the paragraph. According to Rolling Stone, Gill and his allies have set their eyes on, quote, a new front of the movement. They now have a campaign that, quote, pits LGBTQ advocates against a religious right that responded to marriage equality by redoubling its efforts. So what does that mean? Well, that means that they have very strategically set their targets on the southeastern United States. Gill's efforts are now focused on states that, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, that's the ACLU, not only have about a third of LGBT people in America, but have the preponderance of those pesky religious right people who continue to contend that marriage is between one man and one woman. Here is how Rolling Stone has quoted Tim Gill. We're going into the hardest states in the country, and we're going there to punish the wicked. So, I don't know how you respond to that. I don't know how you say to yourself, okay, there is an agenda pressing itself forward out there, and it has got backers like this guy who are willing to pump hundreds of millions of dollars into an agenda advocating that the normalization, I'm going to use that term, the normalization of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer movement. Folks, I got to tell you, anyone who now opposes the LGBTQ agenda in any way, even by refusing to use a rainbow emoji on Facebook, or as we talked about last week, any business that in a community where the police want to have every business post these gay pride decals on their front windows indicating that it's a safe space. Anybody that doesn't do that is going to experience the advocacy efforts of those who want to label people of religious conviction as wicked. That's the word that's used. The word that's used is wicked. And you say to yourself, well, it's not going to ever find its way into, like, I don't know, important places like medicine. Well, you'd be wrong again there, too. Physicians who have a conscientious objection based on their sincerely held religious beliefs to do something. So let's say you are a physician, you serve in a hospital, you do not personally believe that abortion is what we ought to be doing. And so, you know, that's not the area of medicine that you practice in, but your hospital says, oh no, you cannot have a conscientious objection to things like that. Whatever you do in this profession, you are now obligated to provide, perform, and refer patients according to the standards of the profession. You can't have any conscientious objection beyond that. And that's what's now being argued in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. In a recent sounding board article for the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, it is being argued that medical providers' conscientious objection rights should be eliminated. That should be reflected in legislation, that it should be reflected in medical licensure requirements, and that basically, if you are a medical provider, you cannot have a moral objection to any kind of medical intervention. Now, the authors contend that because medical providers, quote, freely choose their professions, they are obligated to do whatever the full scope of procedures and practices is within that particular profession. To support their claim, they appeal to differences between military and medical conscientious objection, to internal inconsistencies within the codes of ethics of various professional medical associations, and to the role of professional morality in determining providers' responsibility to patients. I recommend you go read this particular article by Michael and Grace Stark within bioethics, the bioethics section, and it's posted by Ryan T. Anderson if you're interested in going and grabbing it. It's entitled Physicians Without Chess on the Call to End Conscientious Objection in Medicine. All right, friends, that is a load for today. I do have some good news for you in case you missed it over the weekend. Mosul has been liberated. The Iraqi prime minister has arrived in Mosul just yesterday to declare victory over ISIS. The victory marked the formal end of a very bloody campaign that lasted nearly 9 months. We have talked about the situation in Mosul on a number of occasions. This is Iraq's second largest city. It is now in ruins. I would recommend that at some point you go and look at the images that the Associated Press and others are publishing about what Mosul looks like today. This is a conflict that killed thousands of people, displaced nearly a million people who lived in Mosul, and let's just say that by the pictures, they're not going home anytime soon. Hanging over the declaration of victory is this reality of the very hard road which now lies ahead. The security forces in Mosul still face grave danger, as there are still Islamic State sleeper cells and suicide bombers hither and yon. All right, and there's probably places rigged with explosive booby traps, and so civilians actually cannot return until basic services are restored. And again, if you look at the pictures, basic services are not going to be restored anytime soon. So would you go there on vacation? That, I suppose, is a big question. There's a conversation ongoing about spending your vacation money and your vacation time in the Middle East in places like Egypt for a restoration of tourism there. And if you want to read a little bit about that, Christianity Today has an article that's entitled, Want to Help Christians Stay in the Middle East? Start with your vacation. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. When we come back, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Gerald McDermott about the new Christian Zionism. You don't want to miss that. The Reconnect's a listener-supported ministry, so go by the website reconnectwithcarmen.com and donate to the ministry today. We will be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge and this is The Reconnect. Sometimes it's just a really good reminder that He loves us. He loves us. He loves us. Hey, if you don't get God back into the conversation in any other way today, you could just be an agent of that word of grace, reminding people that they are loved by an eternal and an almighty God, a God who never leaves us and never forsakes us and is interested in not only the number of hairs on our head, but the days of our lives and the eternity that He has planned for us. So just remind folks today that He loves us. We here at The Reconnect are seeking to put God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So that means we're talking about what people are talking about, seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We've got resources posted for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You could go to our Facebook page and like us there. And you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, we have with us today Dr. Gerald, he goes by Jerry McDermott. He's the Anglican Chair of Divinity at Beeson Divinity School of Samford University, an interdenominational evangelical divinity school in Birmingham, Alabama. He's also the Associate Pastor at Christ the King Anglican Church near Birmingham. He's the author or co-author or editor of nearly 20 books, one of which I'm holding in my hand right now. It's entitled The New Christian Zionism: Fresh Perspectives on Israel and the Land. All right, Jerry, welcome to The Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen.
So there's no lack of conversation in the culture today about Israel, but there's a lack of understanding in terms of exactly what the term means when we use it and how we differentiate between Israel as a nation state in the world today and the word Israel when we read it in the Bible. So can we just start the conversation there?
Sure. Most Christians think the resurrection, and I say if because some scholars would say 30, that at that point God stopped His covenant with ethnic Jews, thus ethnic Israel, and no longer was concerned with the land of Israel. So that today the church is the new Israel, and the promises are for the whole world. There are no particular promises anymore for that little strip of land on the Mediterranean, and there are no particular promises anymore for Jews as Jews unless they accept Jesus. And what we in a new movement called the New Christian Zionism want to say is that all of those assumptions are false, and that none of those assumptions are biblical.
All right, so now that sort of lays down the gauntlet, right? So why don't you share with us, we probably don't have time to go into all the reasons why it's false or unbiblical, but can you give us an example?
Sure. So, for example, most Christians have thought that Jews who don't accept that Jesus is Messiah are of no interest to God and that God's covenant with them is not in place until and unless they accept Jesus. And I used to think that, and that's called supersessionism, by the way. It comes from the word supersede, that the church has completely superseded ethnic Israel. It's also called replacement theology, that the church has replaced ethnic Israel as the site of God's promises and God's covenant. And I used to think all of those things, and then one day I took a look at Romans 11 again, and in Romans 11, Paul says that those of you who are enemies of the gospel, and by that he meant his fellow Jews who had not accepted Jesus yet, are still beloved by God. And it's in the present tense, are still loved by God. And that just blew me away. I thought, whoa. Now, Paul was writing this probably in the late 60s, so about 30 years after he had accepted Jesus. And so he's saying now that still a majority of his fellow Jews have still not accepted Jesus. And yet, he says, God still loves them. God has a, still has a special covenant with them, and God's promises to them are still in place. Now, that doesn't mean that every Jew is automatically saved simply by being born a Jew, but it does mean that God still has a special love for people who are ethnic Jews.
Okay, so when you use the term ethnic Jew, I think that one of the conversations that folks who don't have a lot of exposure to Judaism and therefore maybe don't have friends who are Jewish, when you say ethnic Jews, can you differentiate for us Judaism as an ethnicity, Judaism as a religion, and a Jewish state? Do you see how those get, there's a confusion and a conflation,
yes,
among things? And so can you help,
sure,
just sort that out for us?
Yeah, well, basically what we want to say, there's a lot I can say to answer that question, but basically what we want to say is that the present return of Jews in the last 150 years to the land of Israel, and then the establishment of the Jewish state in 1948, and that continues to this day, is a partial fulfillment of the promises of the Old Testament that someday, and also the promises of the New Testament, that someday the Jews will return to the land and be in control of that little land. So is the Jewish state perfect? Of course not. There's no country on earth that is perfect. But is the Jewish state a partial realization, partial fulfillment of the promises, a first fruits of the kingdom that Jesus says in Acts 1:6 he's going to restore, and he says now is not the time for you, my disciples, to know, but someday it is going to happen? Yes.
Okay, so I love two things that you just said that spark my next question. Because as Christians read the Bible, there's lots of references to Israel in these Old Testament prophecies. And so you're talking here about a partial fulfillment of those Old Testament promises. And you also allude to this sort of reading the signs of our times. Like there's things that are happening in the world that we all have some level of interest and fascination with the end times. So what are some of the things that we kind of need to keep in mind so that we don't lose ourselves in maybe imagining that there's a prophecy fulfillment unfolding in every instant as we all seek to advance the kingdom of God in our generation, right? Because we're trying to pursue it and we're trying to help bring it about if that's possible. But how do we not get lost in that? Give us a little bit of perspective in terms of what you all are talking about in New Christian Zionism, its relationship to sort of these prophecies in the Old Testament and the end times.
Well, we in the New Christian Zionism don't attach ourselves to any particular eschatological scenario. That is, in contrast to some dispensationalists, and by the way, our movement has nothing to do with dispensationalism, which was the previous and current home of much of what's called Christian Zionism. In contrast to at least a traditional dispensationalist who had all sorts of particular ideas about how and when the end times are going to take place, we are officially agnostic on those things. We do say, we do believe that the scriptures teach that there is a future for the land of Israel and there's a future for the people of Israel. Those two things are very clear in the New Testament, not just the Old Testament, but in the New Testament. Now, how it's all going to work out, we don't know. We believe it's going to be a gradual process and not all one slam dunk affair. So, for example, in Ezekiel 37, the prophecy about the dry bones coming to life, they come back to life and they start standing step by step, step by gradual step. And many people today say, well, look at all the problems in the state of Israel today. Look at the way that they're oppressing the Palestinians. Now, first of all, I think that last statement is largely untrue. I've been to Israel 14 times, and I've sat on the ground with Palestinians, with Jews, with all sorts of other people and religious minorities in Israel. And the so-called terrible oppression of the Palestinians by the Israelis is not at all what many people in the media would have us believe. But when we look at the church, we say the church is the body of Christ. Paul makes very clear the church is the body of Christ, even though there were terrible problems in the church at Corinth and the church at Ephesus. We look at the church today, and it's full of heresies, it's full of immoralities, it's full of division, and yet we still say it's the body of Christ. Why is it so hard for us to believe that the current return of the Jews in the last 150 years and the current state of Israel might be a first step, a first fruit of the fulfillment of the biblical prophecies that in the end times, God will bring the Jews from all over the world back to his land and start to do a new thing?
So I love in the book, and friends, the book is The New Christian Zionism, Fresh Perspectives on Israel and the Land. We have with us Gerald McDermott. He's the editor of what I will describe, it's not quite a tome, but it's pretty close. And I love this leading paragraph in Daryl Bach's, the 11th chapter, which is, how should the new Christian Zionism proceed? And I just want to read this beginning paragraph to my listeners. It says, Christian Zionism is not an oxymoron. It's an appeal in an era of narratives to get the story right about God, his character, and his promises. Whether one thinks theologically, morally, historically, politically, or legally, the way one views Israel is also a reflection of how one thinks about God. This discussion is a big deal because the character of God, his faithfulness, and his promises are in view. Seeing Israel in the program of God says God keeps his promises to those he originally addressed. And that story is also rooted in reconciliation, an important detail that often gets lost when one dismisses the ongoing significance of Israel. So I wanted people to hear that so that they can get a sense of what we're really talking about. This is not, we're not trying to get way down into the theological weeds in order to be sure that the pie is sliced exactly the right way. We're actually trying to speak the truth on something that's happening in the world today in a way that people need to engage, because the character of God and the faithfulness of God and how God actually interacts with people is what we're talking about. And so this isn't just about Israel, a nation. It's not about a strip of land in the Mediterranean. It's really ultimately about the character and faithfulness of God.
Right. And Carmen, let me tell your listeners that while this book, The New Christian Zionism, is an academic book, and we tried to make it accessible, I've got a new book out that's explicitly written for people in the pews. It's much, much more accessible than The New Christian Zionism. It's titled Israel Matters, and it's available through Amazon. And it's 1/4 the length of The New Christian Zionism, and it tells my story of how I moved from being a classical supersessionist, classical replacement theology guy, to someone who now recognizes that both the people of Israel still matter to God and the land of Israel still matters to God. So that's a little book called Israel Matters, and it's for people in the pews. It's not for scholars.
Oh, I love that. All right. It's Israel Matters, Why Christians Must Think Differently About the People and the Land.
Sure.
Jerry, thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect. I recall that when we were originally going to talk, you had a tragedy in your family, and I just simply wanted to assure you that we prayed for you on the show that particular day and continue to pray for you and your family at the loss of your grandson.
Well, we appreciate that very much, Carmen.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you sometime down in Birmingham, and thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Well, please look me up when you get down there.
You got it. All right, friends, that was Gerald McDermott. He is the Anglican Chair of Divinity at Beeson Divinity School of Samford University, which is an interdenominational evangelical divinity school in Birmingham, Alabama. His lay-friendly version of the New Christian Zionism book, the lay-friendly version, is called Israel Matters, Why Christians Must Think Differently About the People and the Land. All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations, not initially. They don't initially appear to be about God. I assure you, today's does not appear to be about God on the surface. But it does give us an opportunity to introduce eternal principles into a conversation, change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and their living. So what I have for you today is this. I'm having a hard time reading some of these words, so I might have to edit this as I go. This took place at Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo on Thursday. At Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo, there was a distribution of, there's no other way to say it. They're endangered species condoms. There's no other way to say it. I don't have another word for it. So the Center for Biological Diversity, which is a notably left-wing environmental group, distributed hundreds of endangered species condoms in very beautifully, colorfully, artistically packaged containers, boxes. They're small. They look like small little boxes. And they distributed them at the Lincoln Park Zoo. And they distributed them in an effort to raise awareness about the relationship, get this is straight off the website, designed to raise awareness about the relationship between human population growth and the survival of animals. So, in addition to providing colorful artwork of endangered animals and very, very clever marketing taglines, because these are very, very clever, the condom packaging includes these slogans that frankly are designed to discourage people from having children. That's the best way that I can say this. The packaging is designed to discourage people from having children in order that these endangered species might be less endangered because of human population growth. Now you're saying to yourself, what has the world come to? Well, you as a Christian, this is the kind of conversation you need to engage in, because this is the kind of provocative conversation that, frankly, people out in the culture are absolutely willing to have. So if you live in the Chicago area and you happened to receive one of these, I want you to mail it to me, because I would love to have this as a conversation starter with other people. So from a biblical worldview, human beings are not one creature among many other creatures. Okay, there is an order to creation, and human beings are actually created intentionally by God in His image. You're saying to yourself, well, that's not what they teach in schools today, and that's not what you hear in the media today, and that's not what you see in, you know, at government monuments that talk about the age of things. It's not really what you see in a lot of zoos when they talk about the evolution of particular species. I understand that. What I am articulating to you is a biblical worldview about creation, the creation of animals, and the intentional, very different creation of human beings. Human beings are made in the image of God on purpose and for a purpose. Male and female, God created us. Animals do not actually, according to the Bible, have the same rights as human beings. So animal rights advocates are operating out of something other than a biblical worldview. You need to recognize that. And I'm certainly all for the humane treatment of animals. That's not what this is about, because that is a conversation about the stewardship of creation. When I said people were made on purpose and for a purpose, part of the role and responsibility of humanity is the care of God's good creation. God loves what He has made. He considered it good. He declared it to be good. And then He set humanity, human beings, men and women, as stewards over it, to be the caretakers, the managers of what He had made. Human procreation, that's actually the having of children, is a mandate of God. And so I'm not saying that preventing unwanted pregnancies is a bad thing, but the notion that preventing the birth of any more people Is the answer to the concern being raised about the survivability of certain animal species? That is a non-biblical argument. So you could probably make a biblical argument for why we would want to be sure that species of animals continue to thrive and live, but limiting the number of people by intentionally discouraging people from having children, that's not a biblical argument that you can make. And while we're here on this question of whether or not people ought to be having babies, and who we should be concerned about that's having too many babies, well, distributing these condoms at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States of America, isn't really addressing the issue. The issue is not population growth in the United States. The United States happens to be not only the only place that this campaign is being run, this ad campaign is being run, but it's not the culprit of global population growth. At 81%, we are way below what other nations are running in terms of babies per adult. We're at 0.81. Other countries are like way up above 2. So when you talk about population growth in the world today, you're not talking about any industrialized countries. You're talking about developing nations. And so if we're going to spend our money helping people control the birth rate in certain places, and again, I realize that there is a whole spectrum of arguments about whether or not we want to discourage anyone from having babies at all. Babies are great. But the conversation that needs to be had, and these beautiful, beautifully packaged, very cleverly labeled condoms distributed at an evening event at the Chicago Zoo, Lincoln Park Zoo, is probably not really addressing the population that's making a lot of babies in places where these species are also endangered. I know, my staff is now looking at me literally like laughing in the studio. I'm having a hard time addressing this subject. But here you go. I will just say to you this. Babies are great. This is a full circle all the way back around to our conversation about Charlie Gard at the beginning of this hour. Every set of parents out there in the world loves their child and would literally go to the ends of the earth to provide for them. Our ability to provide for our children is going to require among us a restoration of righteousness in our lives individually and in our life together as a people. Charlie Gard is suffering the consequences of the generations from which we live from Eden. He's suffering the consequences, not of anyone's particular sin other than Adam and Eve, but the reality of a fallen world. The same is true when we talk about the capacity of the earth to handle, well, we're now at 7 billion, but it's going to be over 9 billion within my lifetime. And the question of endangered species. All of this gets back to a conversation about the first couple of chapters of the book of Genesis. So that's your reading for this evening. Hey friends, that's all the time we've got for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Please connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.